few weeks ago, when Adele and I were in London, we spent a pleasurable few hours in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And in our wanderings there, we chanced to go through a hall in which the museum collects and displays its English silver. And my eye was drawn to what was, by any account, the largest piece of silver in that hall. It was a 3, maybe 4 foot high presentation piece, which seemed to be covered with various biblical figures. And as I looked more closely, I found Hebrew slaves and Hebrew prophets and even a Hebrew inscription. And the inscription indicated that this presentation silver had been given to the leading Jew of the middle of the 19th century in London, Sir Moses Montefiore. It had been given to him on the occasion of his having successfully negotiated the release of the Jewish community of Damascus. The gift had been given in 1841. The previous year, a Franciscan instructor in Damascus, a man who taught at the Franciscan seminary there, a man by the name of Father Thomas, had been murdered. The French consul in Damascus was a notorious anti-Semite. And he had convinced the Pasha that this death had been an act of ritual murder, which had been, in fact, perpetrated by Jews. One doesn't know historically how much convincing the Pasha required to accept this story. In any case, the Pasha ordered the imprisonment and the torture of 8 of the leading citizens of the Jewish community of Damascus. And this imprisonment and their torture and their obviously false confessions became something of a cause célèbre throughout Western Europe. Europe was just at the beginning of an era of enlightenment in which, if Westerners still were not satisfied that Jews were a people like unto all others, they were nevertheless believed themselves to be beyond medieval superstition. And Sir Moses Montefiore, with some aid from the English government, was able to go to Egypt, where the Khedive Muhammad Ali had nominal suzerainty over Damascus, and by various persuasions, monetary and otherwise, to convince Muhammad Ali to put some pressure on the Pasha to release those Jews in prison who still survived. Now, what merits retelling this story to you today is the fact that in 1841, in August, at the height of this incident, which was well covered in the English press, the London Times undertook to publish a complete translation of the Haggadah. And they did so in order to prove to any of their readers who might still be skeptical about Jewish practice that, in fact, we didn't do anything such as a blood ritual on Seder night. This English translation was published under the heading of the Israelite Seder, and this was the opening paragraph. A correspondent has furnished the annexed, very minute account of this ceremony, which will be exceedingly curious in itself to most of our readers, and have at the same time an evident bearing on the Damascus case. It repels strongly the barbarous notion that human blood, or blood of any kind, is essential to this ceremony. And one likes to believe that the English aristocracy's concerns about the Seder were forever put to rest. Now, how did this idea of blood being necessary, human blood being necessary to the celebration of the Seder, originate? The answer is we don't really know. What we do know is that this canard and libel was promulgated largely in the late 15th and early 16th century by itinerant Franciscan preachers who went up and down Italy and Germany and Central Europe generally with the major purpose of diverting the anger of Christians from the papacy to Jews. This was the beginning of the era of the Counter-Reformation. It was a time of Luther, Calvin, Zwingli. It was a time when the evils and greed of the church were apparent to many. The selling of indulgences and simony, nepotism and sheer greed, the lack of concern by the church for the poor, its traditional areas of concern. And it has been traditional that among all peoples that whenever something precious to you is being attacked, the best way to divert attack is to find somebody else to have that poison directed towards. Now, why this particular canard? Well, in point of fact, the Passover story deals with blood. When the Israelites leave Egypt, the Bible tells us the last of the 10 plagues was a plague which required the death of the firstborn of all Egyptians. And how were the Jewish homes spared by the angel of death? The Jews supposedly sacrificed a lamb and took the blood of the lamb and marked with that blood the lintel of their door, and then the Malach HaMoveth, the angel of death, passed over the Israelite homes. Anthropologists would call this an apotropaic ceremony. That is, a ceremony in which you simulate an evil which you fear in order that the reality of that evil may not take place. By shedding the blood of an animal, by smearing it on your home, you protect that home from the shedding of human blood. And of course, in the Christian conscience, the shedding of blood on the Passover is again reinforced by the whole story of the crucifixion. The crucifixion is inevitably tied up with Seder night, the Last Supper. And in Christian thinking, the paschal sacrifice becomes not the sacrifice of a lamb, but the sacrifice of the Christ, Jesus himself. And medieval Christians had seen in their churches Jesus hanging from the cross with very visible blood dripping down from the various wounds in his body. And so the association of blood and the Passover was an understandable one for these simple, illiterate, superstitious people. But how did it particularly come to be that Jews were assumed to practice a blood ritual on Seder night? Here I must introduce you to a group of men which we would have been far better off without. They're called in Hebrew Malshinim. A Malshin was a defamer. Usually he was a rather neurotic individual who was among those who converted to Christianity during the Middle Ages and who felt, once he had converted, a desperate need to prove the honesty of his change of heart by venting his bile against the people he had left behind. There had to be a good reason why he had left. And so these neurotic individuals would manufacture canards and libels and, against the people that they had left behind. And because Christians couldn't read Hebrew, most of them couldn't even read, they depended upon these Malshinim for whatever information they could have about the contents of Jewish books or Jewish ceremonies. Now, as you know, the medieval Jew on Seder night had a very interesting custom. It was a custom which spoke of relief and release and a need to be revenged upon his enemies. There is, in the course of the traditional Seder service, the listing of the 10 plagues, the Aseret HaMakot. And as the Jew at Seder night would list each of these plagues, Dam, Svardeya, Kinim, he would take his finger, dip it in the cup of wine, and flick the a bit of the wine on the floor of his home. And obviously what was involved here was a kind of emotional release. As these plagues happened to our fathers in the past, may they happen to our enemies in the present. They must have had a wonderful sense that this would in fact occur. Well, the first of the plagues is dam, which means blood. The first of the plagues was the fact that Moses was told to hold his rod over the Nile, and the pure waters of the Nile would turn to blood, the blood which the Egyptians obviously could not drink or could not use to irrigate their fields. And it was very easy for these semi-literate or literate ex-Jews to say, here is the Jews, they require blood, dam, This is simply a definition of a ceremony, not one of the, simply one of the 10 plagues for this particular act. And by making this claim, you had the development of the charge of ritual murder. And one of the interesting things which Jews have had to face throughout history, as does any persecuted minority, is how do you respond to the ignorance, to the superstition, to the vilifications of those who don't know or who are determined that what they know is in fact the truth? Now, if a group is reasonable, it tends to make the mistake that by telling the truth, by being reasonable, it'll be able to lay these superstitions to rest. And so you find in the 16th century the rabbis in Italy counseling their parishioners not to use red wine on Passover, on Seder night, but to use white wine, wine which could not possibly be identified with blood. And you find other rabbis suggesting that the gates of the ghetto be left open on Seder night, and that the Jewish householder leave open the door of his home so that anyone who passed by could look in and learn what that in fact a very innocent ceremony was taking place. The early reformers who shared this unreasonableness simply excised the whole listing of the 10 plagues from the Haggadah, from the service itself. Now I wish one could say that all this had the desired effect. In point of fact, the blood libel has tended to disappear from the European demonology. But I remembered some 10, 12 years ago when I took a group of the ministers from Cleveland to Israel. It was at a time when there were almost nightly flights of Soviet emigres from Vienna into Lida. So we went down very early one morning to Lida to meet a group of these emigres, and we talked to a number of them, and I saw a family of very short, thin people sort of pulled away from the major group in a corner. And I tried to talk to them, but I found I had no dialect or language in common with them. And finally, an Israeli came over and explained to me that these were Russian Jews from Uzbekistan, which is in the far reaches of Soviet Asia. It's a largely Muslim community. And he was able somehow to communicate with them, and he asked them why they had left. And the patriarch of the group responded that 2 years before, there had been a pogrom in his little town in Uzbekistan. The local imam had promulgated the charge of ritual murder, and the people had left the mosque and had killed Jews, and he had decided it was time for his family to leave. Now, interestingly, we're here in America where we don't feel so threatened by these kinds of medieval canards. The Reform movement has seen fit to reintroduce into its new Haggadah the listing of the 10 plagues. But they've gone about it in a way that not only takes away any suspicion that this is a kind of act requiring blood, but they've also wanted to take away the idea that somehow we ought by this act to be relieving of ourselves of some of the pressures of the exile, the pressures of oppression. And so you find this rather interesting reversal of the meaning of this symbol. Though we descend from those redeemed from brutal Egypt, and of ourselves rejoice to see oppressors overcome, yet our triumph is diminished by the slaughter of the foe, as the wine within the cup of joy is lessened when we pour 10 drops for the plagues upon Egypt. Each drop of wine we pour is our hope and prayer that people will cast out the plagues that threaten everyone, everywhere they are found, beginning in our own hearts, the making of war, the teaching of hate, the teaching of violence, and on through 10 concerns of this type. It's a lovely idea. Whether it is as effective or as emotionally satisfying as the earlier ritual, only each individual Jew can testify. You know, there's an old saying among us that familiarity breeds contempt. It's one of those truisms which is rarely true. As any of us knows who has a good friend, a lifelong friend, or a wonderful relationship with a parent, or a wonderful relationship with our spouse, familiarity breeds reverence, respect, greater and greater love sometimes, and admiration, Father, and not contempt. And this is, of course, true in matters religious. The more you understand the many levels of history, the many levels of meaning involved in any given ritual, the more that ritual, that ceremony can mean to you. Which is why, if you look back over the schedule of Sunday morning lectures over the last 28 years, you'll find that almost every Sunday before the Passover, I choose to come back to a single theme, the theme of the Haggadah, the theme of the Passover, to try and deepen the Seder to make it more meaningful for you. And the very fact I've had 28 different lectures on that theme should suggest to you the very many levels of meaning that are possible there, and I'll find 28 more in the years that lie ahead. Since I began thinking about translations of the Haggadah, the London Times Haggadah, I began to ask myself, when was the first translation of the Haggadah completed? There's nothing wrong with translating the Haggadah. The Talmud tells us that Jews can worship and do worship in any language. Every language is acceptable to God. And Haggadah itself is a mixture of Hebrew and of the Aramaic of the Jews of a later time. But when was the first translation of the Haggadah in what we might call modern European history? It turns out that it was made in Frankfurt on Main in the year 1512. And what I found surprising was that it is not a translation done into German or into Yiddish, as you would expect for the Jews of Frankfurt, but it is a translation done into Latin, a language which Jews almost never spoke. And my interest was piqued, and I found that as I looked at the text in the book, it turned out to be an Haggadah translated by Christians for Christians, not Haggadah translated for Jews at all. Now, why in 1512 would a Christian printing house and a Christian translator believe that there's an audience for a Jewish book, a Hebrew book like the Haggadah? And thereby hangs another interesting tale. We're still back in the age of the Counter-Reformation, the age of Luther, the age of the Reformers, Zwingli and Calvin. But as you know, there were two issues facing the church at the time. One was that of reformation of those who had broken away, of those who denied the authority of the papacy. And the other was a challenge raised by men like Erasmus and Reuchlin, men who were Christian humanists, whose major issue was not the authority of the papacy, but whose issue was the legitimacy of studies other than the narrow range of theological studies which were being permitted by a papacy which was increasingly concerned with orthodoxy and heresy. And these humanists began in the early part of the 16th century what history calls a battle of the books. And their battle of the books with the church was not over church authority, but over the fact that there were in the books of Arabs, in the books of Hebrews, matters of great interest to the Western world. All through Europe in the early part of the 16th century, Dominican friars spread out, speaking for the Vatican, eager to ban all non-Catholic books and to burn all non-Catholic books. History did not permit, they said, the spread of error, the spread of heresy, the spread of that which cannot be accepted by the church. The humanists rose up in righteous outrage at this kind of destruction of civilization. Yes, they said, the church has a right to prevent calumnies against the church, calumnies against the person of the Pope, but the church has no right to destroy the wisdom of the classics, the wisdom of the Arabs, the wisdom of the Jews, for there is much there that it could be benefit to all of us. And when they looked at the Hebrew text primarily and principally, they were interested at two levels. They were interested first at the proper understanding of the Bible itself, because over the years the church had operated simply through translations. And secondly, they were interested in medieval Jewish philosophy and in the Kabbalah, in philosophy and in theosophy, areas which were as much an interest to Christian theologians as they had been to rabbis and to the Muslim teachers. In 1509, one of those neurotic Malshinim I have been telling you about, a man by the name of Johann Pfefferkorn, a Jew from Moravia who had converted to the Catholic Church and who spent the rest of his life writing one scurrilous pamphlet after another, defaming this teaching or that book or that tradition of his birth people, had published a volume in which he had announced to the world that here was a definitive account of how the blind Jews observe their Easter. And what he went on to do in Latin was to twist and turn every aspect of the Haggadah so that the Haggadah becomes an anti-Christian, anti-civilization document which could only be practiced, participated in by a benighted and blind, spiritually blind people. In Frankfurt, which is one of the centers of European humanism, a movement was undertaken to print in translation some of the basic documents of the Jews, not out of love for Jews so much, but in order to show that there was matter of value in these books. The Haggadah is a small book. It is easily translated. It was one of the first books to be translated into Latin as part of this battle of the books, the battle between those who said ban and burn, and the battle between those who said there are things of value here. Now, having gotten my mind wrapped around this issue of translation, I began to look at other translations of the Haggadah. There are many of them. There are a number of books, Hebrew Haggadot, which were published in the 16th and early 17th century in Venice. And they're fascinating because they are divided into four columns. The first column is the Hebrew Aramaic Haggadah text itself. The second is a translation into Judeo-German, that is Yiddish. The third is a translation and commentary into Judean Castilian, Judean Spanish, which is Ladino. And the fourth is a translation into Judeo-Italian, a form of the Italian of the time. The Venice of the 16th, 17th century was a Venice with the first ghetto in Europe. And inside the ghetto, there were people from three distinct communities. German Jews who had come down for reasons of trade, the Italian Jewish community, which had been there for a long time, and the exiles from Spain who had come there after the expulsion from Spain in 1492. Each had his own synagogue, and the printer of Haggadot from Venice wanted to make sure that his Haggadah could be used by people at any one of those shuls. So, wise businessman that he was, he presented this four-columned Haggadah. But the most interesting of the Italian translations of the Haggadah was not done into Italian, but was done into Spanish, and was done in the year 1654 in the city of Leghorn, Livorno, in southern Italy. The Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. That is, they were told to leave or to convert. 600,000 left. We believe as many as 800,000 converted. Now, many of those who converted became what we call Marranos. The word Marrano is a Spanish word which means pig. It was the defaming word which the Spanish used against those whom they believed to be false Christians. And the interesting thing is that they were right in this assessment to a very large degree. Because all during the 15th century and the 16th century, Jews would come out, Marranos would come out of Spain and make for Venice or make for Leghorn, places which were not far by sea from the Spanish ports, where they could revert to Judaism. And then they usually moved on into the Turkish Empire, where Jews at that point were allowed a degree of freedom. They weren't allowed any place else in Europe, and sometime later they were able also to go to Amsterdam. Now, when you came out in, let's say, 1500 or 1510, You were still of the generation that had gone to Hebrew schools, that could read Hebrew, that at one time or another openly practiced their Judaism. When you came out in the 1650s, you were of the fifth or sixth generation of those who had had to live nominally as Christians. You'd gone to Catholic schools, you had learned Latin, you knew the Catholic curriculum, and things Jewish were rudimentary at the very best to you. You certainly could not read Hebrew, and you knew very little about the practices and customs of the Jewish tradition. And so this translation, done in Livorno, in Leghorn, 1654, contains not one word of Hebrew. It's an attempt very simply to explain the practices, the basic practices of Seder night for Muranos who come out understanding very, very little of the tradition. You find them using Catholic words in order to explain Jewish traditions. And it's very much as we might explain the Haggadah to very young children in junior high school. But what's also interesting as to what's important. And in addition to explaining to them the four questions, to explaining to these people the custom of opening the door for Elijah, you found that at the end of the book contains a series of recipes, for the basic needs of the Seder. And I've got one for you. It's a recipe for the charosis. And let me read it to you because I think it includes an ingredient that none of you have ever thought of putting in charosis as often as you've made it. Now this is for Muranos coming out. Take apples or pears cooked in water, hazelnuts or almonds, shelled chestnuts or walnuts, figs or raisins. And after cooking, grind them thoroughly. Dissolve them in the strongest wine vinegar that can be found. Now here's the new ingredient. Then mix in a bit of brick dust in memory of the bricks which our fathers made in Egypt. And for the eating, a little cinnamon powder is sprinkled above. Now just if that is a little too bitter for the taste, the editor adds, those who wish may add other fruits and spices into the concoction as they wish. The Haggadah has been used over the years for many purposes and many reasons. It's been used to instruct in basic ritual. It's, of course, a great prayer service with the themes of redemption past and redemption yet to come. But the Haggadah has had another history, and that is that there have been those who have used the Haggadah not to express the traditional text, which was established in the 3rd, 4th century of this era, but to express their own special understanding of what they would like Jewish life to be all about. And so if you were to make a collection of Haggadot from Palestine from the 1920s and the 1930s, particularly if you went out to the kibbutzim, you would find in these Haggadot that every reference to God has been omitted. These were young socialists for whom the synagogue and theology had no meaning. It was a part of the repression of the past. And you would find these Haggadot are filled with songs about the land and about the nation. They have that redemptive element to it, but not that of divine redemption. Again, a personal experience. A few years ago during our sabbatical, we were in Japan during Seder. And we got as far as Kyoto and made arrangements to go to a Seder down in Kobe. But we were told by the woman in Kobe that there were a few Jews in Kyoto and they might invite us to Seder. Now the might was intriguing because the first thing a Jew does is to say, Seder, anybody in town who needs to come, the door is open. Well, we met the young couple that were in charge of that Seder and we passed muster. And I discovered a little later the reason for the test to which we were put. These were, for the most part, young Israelis who were in Japan for one kind of study or another. And the last thing they wanted at their Seder was an Orthodox rabbi who would impose upon them the traditional regimens as far as food and ritual are concerned. And when we got to the Seder, which was a wonderful mixture of Japanese and Polish food, eaten cross-leg on, the table was about 6 inches off of the floor, I found that I knew the ritual, and they knew the songs, and between us we got along, but I wasn't sure what the Seder would have been like if I hadn't been there, and I know what they think the Seder would have been like if I hadn't been there. Now, by and large, this kind of ideological atheism has been dropped in the kibbutzim. And it's interesting when you think of the power of the Seder to think that these doctrinaire anti-synagogue people maintain the Seder as part of their ritual. But we find Sedarim that Haggadot, which were written by Christian missionaries, in which they try to use the text in order to insert ideas of their own. And interestingly, we also have a number of Haggadot which were published in the Soviet Union by the Communist Party, by the Jewish Commissariat of the Communist Party, which intend to use the familiar elements of the Seder night in order to get across their own teaching. I found, for instance, in a 1929 Russian communist Haggadah, in which the opening halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt, let all who are hungry come and eat, is explained this way. Halach ma'anya, for the bread of affliction did every capitalist buy our blood and sweat. Driven by hunger, we became voluntary slaves to capital. Our Jewish caretakers, lovely pillars of the community and rabbis, taught us to be patient. They wanted to persuade us that we are hungry and lonely only because we are in exile. They transformed their festivals into a means for the benighting and enslavement of the people. And the Hallel, the singing of the great psalms of praise, begins this way. Sing the international and say, down with the mildew of the ages, down with clerical nationalist festivals, long live the revolutionary workers' holidays. I don't know how that all set to music, but that's the text that's there. One of the reasons I've always known that somehow we'd survive this kind of ideology is that it's so heavy. It has no life and lilt to it. Now, by way of conclusion, we've been talking to a very large degree of how the outside world has affected what is, after all, one of the most natural indigenous spiritual expressions of our people. This has been true throughout the ages. We know very little about how Seder night was celebrated in homes outside of Jerusalem while the temple was still in being. But we do know that on Erev Pesach, families of men, groups of men would come up from all parts of Israel, and they would bring with them a lamb, and the lamb would be taken to the temple where it would be ritually sacrificed. The blood of the lamb would be spilled on the altar. Blood was a symbol of the life, the living essence of itself. And this was, again, an apotropaic ceremony designed to ensure the aliveness, the continued life of that group of people. And then they would take the animal, which was, in a sense, barbecued, and they would take it to a room which they had hired in or near Jerusalem. And they would sit down around the table. They would share the roasted lamb, and they would talk about the redemption that had been, the exodus from Egypt, and the redemption that was yet to be, the coming of the Messiah, the ultimate redemption of mankind. Now, with the destruction of the temple, this whole ceremony had to be transferred from the temple in Jerusalem into the home. It's the one ceremony which was not transferred to the synagogue. It was transformed to the individual home. And we don't know quite how all of the various ceremonies developed. We do know that by the 4th century, most of the Haggadah, as we know it now, except for some of the songs at the end, were already in being. But there's an interesting anomaly to the Haggadah as it appeared as early as the 4th or 5th century. And that has to do with the four questions. If you look at the four questions, they're designed, obviously, to be the rather innocent questions a child would ask who has observed a family eating the Passover meal and says, why is this night different? Why are things different tonight than they were before? Why do we eat matzah? Why do we eat reclining, which was a symbol of free men in the Roman Empire? Why do we dip the herbs twice? Why do we eat the bitter herbs? Why do we eat certain vegetables? The child would have had to see these customs in order to ask about them. But if you look at your Haggadah, and this has been true for the last 1,500 years, now the questions precede the meal. They don't follow it. Why this change of place? Well, in the 4th and 5th centuries, the Christian church began to celebrate Seder. And they appropriated to their own purposes almost all of the symbols of the Seder. Jesus was the Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God, the Paschal sacrifice. The church by this time had created the Mass with the idea of transubstantiation, where the wafer and the wine, the matzah and the wine, become the body and the blood of the Christ. The maror, the bitter herb, became in the early church a symbol of the bitterness of the Passion. And so among these groups of people who had, many of them, been Jews and begun to break away from Judaism, the Seder was observed as a Christological moment. And the Jews wanted to make sure that the original concept of redemption, which was Jewish and not Christian, was the concept that comes out of the observance. And so the questions are asked early, so the answers may be given before the meal, so there's no question that at the meal you are participating in a rite which Jews would have been believed idolatrous, eating the god, a communion meal in which wine and matzah are transformed into the divinity itself. And you get a whole emphasis in the Haggadah, which is an attempt to define it again as what it had been from the beginning, a preternaturally and uniquely Jewish ceremony. There is also another evidence of this. There, later on, in the right after the four questions, one of the children at our table asks three little questions. What is the meaning of Pesach? What is the meaning of matzah? And what is the meaning of maror? Now, why was this added? Again, so that the Paschal sacrifice could be defined in terms of Egypt, not in terms of the crucifixion, so that the matzah could be defined as the bread of affliction which our fathers baked in haste, not in terms of a symbol of the body of the risen Lord, and so the maror can be defined as bitter herbs, as a remembrance of the bitterness of slavery and not in Christological terms. Now, what is the difference, ultimately, between these two great religious doctrines of redemption? We celebrate Passover night as Jews, the God who redeemed us from Egypt. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It is God who redeems. The redemption is a physical one. It is a political one. It's the establishment of independence. It is the establishment of one's own destiny through the grace of God. And as you know, there's always been a strong element in the Jewish tradition that the redemption that is yet to be will be a this-worldly redemption, with a Jewish state again in being, with peace and justice established throughout the world. The Christian doctrine of redemption is one which moves away from this political, this-worldly element and talks in terms of salvation of the soul through the death, the passion of the Savior. There is something in the Christian tradition which is called original sin. In Adam's fall, we sin it all. And one cannot, according to the Christian doctrine, escape from the thraldom of original sin unless one has faith in this act of self-sacrifice, of suffering by the Savior sent by God. And only those who participate in this salvific act, in fact, merit salvation. It's an interesting, it's obviously powerful and compelling doctrine. Jews have never felt that salvation is limited to those who affirm a particular faith. The righteous among all nations have a share in the world to come. Nor have we looked upon salvation as something which is simply available to the individual as apart from the community. We share Seder night together. We share it as a community. Salvation and redemption, when it comes, will come as it came to the people of Israel as a community, to all mankind as a community. There are differences of emphasis and difference of focus in these two great redemptive doctrines. And on Seder night, the Haggadah does the best that it can to suggest to those who lead the Seder the theme of redemption, the theme of freedom, the theme of the work which we must do, each of us and together, in order to make possible redemption for our world. And if I were to offer any suggestion to all of you for Seder night, it is simply this, that Haggadah is an open invitation not only to be read through as quickly as you can so you can get to the dainties of the meal, but it's an open invitation to think about its themes and to dwell on these with whatever concerns, with whatever insight, and whatever wisdom all around the table can share. Amen.